Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for
Happy 200 to you.
What is happening?
Happy 200 to you.
Nick, it is our 200th episode. When I bought all of this podcasting equipment, I didn't think we would record one episode.
Absolutely same. Same here.
This week, I'm not looking for a book. I'm looking for a Marquette University's Tolkien archivist to help me here, two high school English teachers.
Yeah. Well, Nick, if you're looking for a Marquette archivist, I brought Bill Fliss this week. I don't know who Ian brought.
I brought Bill Fliss too. Oh, this is weird. I was hoping, Joe, I was hoping we could play that down the line of like, let's go on a quest together to find him.
Sure.
And let's encounter various dangers and learn something about ourselves along the way. But you just went straight to the joke of I brought him. So
yeah,
good for you.
Yeah.
Yes, way to step on
good
that bit.
Joke, yep. Joe.
Yeah, I'm still learning how to do this.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher, and this week I also will talk to
is
Bill
exploding
Fliss.
With joy as we have mm-hmm. brought a Tolkien expert on,
vibrating at a high frequency.
Okay, well, get that checked out.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs. laughs.
200 episodes of pure wisdom.
I call it WTWW, which stands for wall to wall wisdom.
Incredible. Gentlemen, do you think I don't know if there's anybody out there who hasn't listened to every episode, but
no.
I thought it would be interesting.
Litheads are completionists, as we
right.
know.
It would be interesting if you guys shared some of your favorite books over the course of our 200 episodes, because we brought a total of what should be 400 books recommendations.
But that's not how the math works at all.
But we have so many cop-out episodes, episodes when we have guests on, such as today. So I think it's in like the 300s, but that's still a lot of book you read.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You guys did a lot of book reading.
We did a lot of reading.
Think about how many skills you could have learned in all that time.
10,000 hours
I could have learned to code.
learn to code. I was looking back through the books that I have brought, and there are absolutely multiple books in this list where I'm like, I have no memory.
Don't
remember.
As Gandalf would say, I have no memory of this place.
Yes. Ian, what have been your favorite books over the last 200 episodes? And are they all just your books that you're about to share?
Absolutely.
Okay. 100%.
I don't have notes from Joe's. I still recommend Piranesi to people. I love Piranesi so much that I read the first book that Susanna Clarke wrote, which is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is, I think maybe I love it as much as Piranesi. It shot to near the top, probably my top 10.
What is it about, quickly?
Piranesi is the one where there's the guy trapped in the marble statues place, and there's water flowing, and Nick has no recollection of this place.
I remember the name.
It's like a man stuck in a labyrinth, and then like this mystery unfolds. Piranesi is also on my list of my
That's
favorite
awesome.
Books.
It's an incredible litheads. You gotta read Piranesi.
It's so unlike any other book I've ever
absolutely.
Read.
Absolutely, and it's just engaging, and it's a mystery, but it draws you in. Brilliant, brilliant. 10 out of 10. I really do. One of the first books I brought to the podcast for an episode about the great outdoors is Desert Solitaire, Season in the Wilderness by Edward Abbey. Here's what I said about it. The voice is unique, blending humor and pathos and adventure and philosophy and nature descriptions. The place he's talking about, the Colorado Plateau, is hard to get to and harder to get into. And he gets into it in the way few others have. It's a book that makes you realize your smallness and shows you a way to cope with that smallness. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus said, "All things move and nothing remains still, and you cannot step twice into the same stream." Desert Solitaire displays this beautifully, but gives it just a touch of hopefulness as well as sadness.
Ian, I think it's interesting that you talk about nature books, because actually one of the categories that I wanted to talk about today was books that Ian brought that I really, really want to read after he talks about them. And since we've talked, I read Sand County Almanac. This is one of Ian's favorite books of all time, at least how he pitched it at the time. It's a naturalist, a professor of ecology from Wisconsin.
Essays on nature.
Essays on nature. He writes about Wisconsin. He writes about the Southwest. You pitched it on an early episode of this show, and right away I was like, this book sounds amazing. I read it this past winter, and it was such a beautiful winter book. The book starts in January in Wisconsin, and I sent you a text when I got to this.
Yeah, you did. That's right, you did.
Because it made... Wisconsin, for litheads that don't know, it feels often very dead in the winter. It feels like nothing happens. It feels like the earth stands still for 5 months. This book makes Wisconsin winters feel alive, and I absolutely loved it. I read it this past January over, I think, maybe Christmas break, so maybe December. I super dug it. I
loved it. Story's falling apart.
Well, yeah, I read it, guys. I definitely read it.
I think every Wisconsinite needs to read Sand County Almanac. Another one I really liked is... we did a micro histories. We after a while, we realized, okay, we're reading a lot of these books that say, hey, this tiny thing seems super important. So I read Mark Kurlansky's book, Salt. And Joe, that week, read Cod, right?
But maybe Cod. I think that's what I read for micro histories.
Gotta be a John McPhee book. Is that?
Yeah, possibly John McPhee. This was not a John McPhee
book. I chose deliberately when I was choosing these. I did not choose any John McPhee because I knew I'd be shouted down. But Salt, I love because flowed from one area of, I don't know, history, culture, human development to another, from one time period to the next. It sounds so dorky when you say it out loud, but it's really good.
But it works. And when it works, it works. Yep. One of the categories I brought this week was books I am still so pissed that they lost. Right? Like books I'm still so upset they lost. Yes.
Can't sleep at night.
Mm-hmm. And over time on this show, over the 200 episodes, losses, Nick, I hate to say it, they sting less than they used to, right? Like losing is just part of the game here.
You just hold on our souls is slipping.
On an early episode, though, we brought, maybe the theme was like books about animals, talking animals. Ian brought The Adventures of Frog and Toad. I brought Charlotte's Web.
Yeah.
I had not read Charlotte's Web since I was a little kid. I reread it as an adult.
Amazing.
It is a stunningly beautiful book. It is so good. It was amazing. I was so pissed I lost.
Doesn't sound too great.
It's a lovely book. It's what you think it is. It's Charlotte and Wilbur and some pig and all that stuff. But it is so beautifully written. It is written by Mr. Omit Needless Words himself, E.B. White.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a beautiful book. Charlotte's Web. You heard it here first.
I just want to shout out some of the friendships we've made along the way. mostly people that Nick has now learned to hate the sound of their name. Uh-huh. Cormac McCarthy. Well, that's not one. That's more like
fan of the show.
People in our lives are done with Cormac McCarthy. John McPhee, aforementioned John
fan
McPhee
of the show.
Is
he's dead, right?
Banned.
No,
he's still
not
alive.
Dead.
Don't you
super
put that
alive.
Evil
friend
on him?
Of the show.
Friend of the show. Roald Dahl has come up a lot. Toni Morrison has come
show.
Up a lot.
Fan of the show. Did you say Ursula K. Le Guin?
Ursula K. Le Guin. That's the last one. Yes.
Ungodly amount.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're excited to welcome our guest.
Welcome, Bill Fliss.
Guys, Bill's a pretty big deal. I feel like this is something I'm going to put on YouTube and it's going to live there for all of eternity. And like the Tolkien fandom is going to come out to play.
Just going
to
come and get it.
They are going to tear us apart.
Yeah, they're going to hate us so much. I can't believe you didn't ask him about chapter 14 of the...
Well, here we go. To the wolves. We are excited to have Bill Fliss with us, Marquette University's Tolkien archivist and co-creator for the exhibition J.R.R. Tolkien, The Art of the Manuscript at the Hegarty Museum of the Art of Art. of oh, art.
So close.
On Marquette.
Really good.
That was so
art,
close.
Art. You got
of
it.
Art, yeah. Of the art. Yep. So Marquette owns the manuscripts for The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings. Ian, would you like to pronounce this one?
Yeah. Ian, go.
Farmer, I can't read your mind.
Farmer
Giles of Ham.
Of obviously. Ham.
You just need to say the first four letters and I have it.
And Mr. Bliss, as well as the research collections, totaling over 11,000 pages. So, Bill, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We have, over the course of 200 episodes, talked about Lord of the Rings probably as much as you would expect three white guys, middle-aged white guys who have a literature podcast to talk about Lord of the Rings. So, like, we try to keep it in check.
It's quite a bit, yeah.
It's quite a bit. We try to keep it in check, but, you know, it gets the best of us constantly, I would say.
It's entirely understandable.
Yeah, and so over the course, you know, we've shared a plenty Hobbit facts, and, you know, one day we kind of stumbled upon the knowledge, or Ian shared with us that... in our own backyard in Wisconsin, here is this amazing collection and archive and just a wealth of history on Tolkien. And so, yeah, we're excited to have you here. And we'd love to kind of just pick your brain a little bit on what this collection is, what this archive is, and kind of share it with people. Because I think it's kind of like this hidden gem.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Yeah, happy to
pick away.
Happy to, yeah.
Okay, so for people who don't know, kind of introduce this collection for us. What does Marquette have in their, I would assume, dark dungeony cellars of
behind like the locked doors? Yeah. There's a troll with riddles, I would imagine.
Yeah, there's no troll. There are doors.
Okay. That's good. That's smart.
Good.
Kind of like the gates of Gondolin. There's multiple ones leading up to the treasury. But we're not actually in the dungeon. We were once upon a time in the old library, but now we're up on the third floor of the new library,
windows.
A newer library. Beautiful climate-controlled area, just wonderful reading room looking out on the south side of the campus. Beautiful spots. In your introduction, you summed up nicely what we have, really, which is the manuscripts for four of his works, The Hobbit, Farmer Giles of Ham, Mr. Bliss, and then his magnum opus, The Lord of the Rings. And so when we say we have own the manuscripts for them, and you mentioned 11,000 pages, what we have really are all the material that went into creating the books, or almost all the material. So handwritten drafts, typewritten drafts that Tolkien annotated and edited, plot notes, everything from the initial concept almost to like the galley sheets, you know, before it was published and printed out for distribution. All that's here at Marquette for those four works in particular. So we don't have everything that's like manuscript for Tolkien. The other place in the world to go for manuscripts is where you might actually expect to find them, and that's Oxford, where Tolkien spent most of his adult life as a professor. They have his... you know, professional papers, of course, as a professor, and most of the material related to his broader legendarium. So if listeners are familiar with the Silmarillion, have ever tackled that beast and slayed it, that's where those manuscripts are for all those legends and stories. But we're very happy to have, especially The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, because those, I think, are the works that Tolkien is most known for. But I would just add real briefly here that we got those many, many years ago, and I can explain kind of how that happened, but they were like a seed for a broader collecting on Tolkien. So we began to collect secondary works. And so we have an enormous library of pretty much everything that's been published on Tolkien. And we've also document the fandom and gather together a lot of hard to find sources that Tolkien scholars may find useful. So it's more than just the manuscripts, but the manuscripts are the heart of the collection, and they're really the seed that grew everything else.
Really cool. Tolkien?
I usually say Tolkien.
Tolkien?
Oh, I've been saying it wrong my whole life. Oh,
well, Nick.
Is it Aragorn? Aragorn.
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 Aragorn. Aragorn.
It's the boy. It's the boy. 2005.
It's very Midwestern to say token.
That's it?
Oh, yeah?
Well, like, it is appropriate that his works are residing in the Midwest, that we put our stamp on it, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Just, that's we want people funny. To know.
Okay. How did you get into this job?
Well, I came to Marquette 20 years ago.
Or calling.
Yeah. I came 20
years ago. How did you take up
ago.
This quest?
It was like Frodo, it was thrust upon me. Oh. I didn't go looking for it. It happened. No, I came to Marquette.
This is my favorite interview ever.
I came 20 years ago and was actually came in to work with an entirely different collection. And for the first 8 years or so I was here, I worked with that collection and other collections and did a bunch of other stuff here. And then the guy or the head of the department that was the Tolkien curator left for a job elsewhere. He became the state archivist of Wisconsin. He went back to the Wisconsin Historical Society, which was kind of, I think, a dream job for him. Mm-hmm. And so in the interim, I assumed the duties for the collection. And then the new dean came on, or the dean decided I was doing pretty well with it. The new department head came on. And so the decision was made to sort of keep it within my wheelhouse. And so that I began working more intensely with it. And it's not the only thing I do here by any means. I wish it was sometimes, but I wear a lot of different hats. And so this is one of the collections, but it does, of all the collections, it does take up the most of my time.
And podcasting time, I would imagine.
Right.
Yeah. Now from time to time, yeah.
Okay, so how did, tell the story of like how, okay, so you have a really interesting AMA on Reddit. Like if you Google your name and Tolkien.
You read through that.
It's the first. Huh? Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
Right. We do our research.
Yeah, we do
absolutely.
Research. And like it's really interesting. And I was looking through to ask questions that didn't come up. I didn't find any because it is extensive and you answer things really well.
I'm glad you think so because that was a horrifying experience at one point doing the Reddit. Because I didn't realize that I've never used Reddit before. So I'm sitting there and I'm answering the questions. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, this is fine. This is going really well. And then I didn't realize like, you had to refresh to get more questions. And then when I realized there's something like 1,000 more questions,
oh,
and I had
no.
this panic moment like, oh my God, I can't possibly do
can't
all
do
these.
This fast enough.
Unreal.
Well, and reading those answers and the responses to your answers, there's some hardcore Tolkien nerds.
Oh, yeah.
Putting me to shame. My goodness.
Like and the polls. And you notice I definitely deflected a lot of those questions because either, you know, it would take forever or I don't know myself. I've never given what they ask a moment's thought. You know, how am I supposed to compose a beautiful path, you know, response on the
fly?
It
was the floodgates for sure. I mean, it keeps going. I think the biggest question is why does Marquette have all of this?
I can sum it up in one little phrase. It pays to be the first to ask.
Hey, there you go.
Because Marquette, there's a fellow at Marquette, William Reedy, who was hired to be the library director of this brand new library that Marquette built. And he was given the task of stocking it with books and manuscripts. And this was when Marquette was like trying to, I think, go from being more of just a liberal arts college to a research university. And so he looked around for things to collect and he decided he would collect the papers of Catholic authors because Marquette's a Jesuit Catholic university. It made sense. And so he identified Tolkien as a Catholic author. This is 1956. He was hired. The Lord of the Rings had just come out. Reedy had read it. He had been familiar with The Hobbit from many years earlier. And he hired a friend of his in London to serve as Marquette's agent. And this fella, Bertram Rhoda, approached Tolkien and basically asked if he would sell the manuscripts to Marquette. And a period of negotiation followed. And then in May 1957, Bertram Rhoda visited Tolkien at his home in Oxford, spent the day with him. And then they came to an agreement for the sale of the manuscripts here. So it really, apparently nobody had really asked him if they wanted his manuscripts. I think at that point in British culture, the British institutions weren't really collecting the papers of living authors. I think if something wasn't hundreds of years old, it wasn't really deemed worthwhile.
Right.
So I don't think they recognized what they had.
Of course.
In a way, we kind of swooped in and got them. But I think that happened a lot. You know, after the Second World War, you know, there were complaints about Americans coming over and right. buying up the papers of living authors, and that the British culture has changed over there now, where they do, you know, keep those, try to keep those things in the country.
There was an example of this, kind of what you're talking about with keeping things in the country. My specialization is Shakespeare and his contemporaries, and it wasn't a Shakespeare volume. It was, I want to say, a volume of Johnson, Ben Johnson. And if I'm remembering correctly, there was an American bid to buy this fairly important early, we're talking like 100 centuries old book. And I believe there was a public fundraising campaign in England to raise enough to counter that bid and keep the book in England. Of course, this is another example.
Enterprising Americans,
but yeah, like you gotta keep a hold of it.
I bring it. It's interesting because like one of the questions that stood out to me on the AMA was, are you guys still buying, you know, pieces of his works and his collection? And your response is, we can't compete anymore. Like, it's just financially sure, yeah. not doable. Like it's so interesting that you say like, hey, we were the first to ask before this was, you know, what it is now, which is a global phenomenon. Right.
The greatest cold call of maybe all time. It was like, hey, John, this is Marquette.
Yeah.
Yep, it's one of the great acquisitions, certainly. I mean, when you consider that it's essentially priceless now, over the years, especially right. once Tolkien died, the value, monetary value soared. That usually happens with authors. Once they pass away, the value rises. And now it's just mind-boggling.
I feel like we should pause for Ian to ask a question, because I think he's going to explode if he doesn't ask something soon.
No, great. That gets to a question I had, because like I saw that comment, and I've spent some time around rare books and around collections, and I know that the market is bonkers, and I think especially for sort of major, like there's the literary element, there's the historical element with Tolkien, there's also the media element. So if you were kind of given carte blanche, like the Holy Grail, like what would you acquire? What Tolkien object or addition? What do you want if money and if it were available? Right. Money were no object. What would you grab?
Well, I think the Holy Grail, as I see it, and it's fitting to call it a Holy Grail, I think, because it's almost this mythical thing that you kind of wonder if it ever existed in some cases, was the original scrap of paper that with the student exam on it that Tolkien supposedly, on more than one occasion, said, you know, he was sitting there grading this exam. It was the summertime.
Wow. Yeah.
He was always short of money, and so he would kind of rent himself out as a grader. Grading exams. It's like intellectual factory work. You know, you're reading the same essay over. It's like people, I don't think
Joe does that.
Yeah. Like AP, like reading AP exams.
Yeah,
like
100%. AP
yeah, it's like the same thing. And so he came upon a page where the student had left the page blank, and he was like, oh, this is glorious. And then he claims that he wrote, you know, in a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit. And that was the start of that. And I think he repeated the story more than once, and there's no reason to doubt his veracity. But if that existed and could be acquired, that would be incredible. That would be such a kind of object moment to the Hobbit, because we have the analog in the Lord of the Rings. We have the original page when he sat down around December 16th, 1937, to start writing what was supposed to be a sequel to the Hobbit. We have that first page. Where he started writing the first chapter, A Long Expected Party. And so that's like the start of the Lord of the Rings, and it would be really cool to have that initial Hobbit page. So Ian, that would be my I think it existed, but I doubt it exists anywhere. I mean, it'd be almost 100 years ago. I don't know why it would exist.
Yeah. What do you guys do with your old student papers?
doing archival papers, right? I set them aside in an acid-free box. Right?
Are there any pieces that as you've spent now, what, 12 years with the collection, are there any pieces that kind of have grown in significance either to you as you've spent more time with them, got to know better kind of like what they signified, or as the Tolkien media brand just balloons and are there pieces that have, I guess we could say, appreciated in intellectual or scholarly value?
With the Tolkien manuscripts, it's challenging to talk about them as pieces. I mean, when you do a museum exhibition like we did with Art of the Manuscript, or like Oxford did with Maker of Middle Earth, or the French National Library with Tolkien, Journey to Middle Earth, it's presented as individual discrete pieces. That's kind of the way I think more museums operate. But the essence, the spirit of the collection is I guess the aggregate in a way, or the idea of something as an object might be a draft, meaning 20 pages of a chapter that together form this kind of unit. And so for me, the significance that struck me of it, I don't know that there's individual pieces that have grown on me, but I think just understanding better how everything fits together and kind of what it says about how he wrote as an author, that's been really, that's been very powerful for me. Now, we have loaned out manuscripts to exhibitions, and they've gone on display, and so some of them have become sort of iconic, where a lot of places that want to do exhibitions that may contact us, they want the same they want the same items because they recognize them and want to include them in there.
The greatest hits.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah. Because Marquette's collection is great, but in terms of like visually stunning manuscripts, we can't hold a candle to what's at the Bodleian, because they have his actual, like his paintings and a lot of his more formal artwork. With ours, it's usually drawings or sketches that might be on manuscript pages, or it might be a page that has an important piece of information on it, or represents a pivotal moment in the composition. And so it's not it may be like, it's a little piece of paper that has pencil scribblings on it. That isn't that exciting, you know? but it is, if you think about what it means within within the whole history of say writing The Lord of the Rings. A great example of this is a piece we had in the exhibition at the Haggerty, which was a page from the chapter the Field of Cormallen, which it appears towards the end of The Lord of the Rings in Book 6. It's when Frodo and Sam are hailed on the field by the Lords of the West and the host there, and it's a great celebration. And there's a manuscript page, which if you just look at it, it's like, oh, it's just like a sloppy ink-filled page of manuscript.
Right.
But there's this point where there are these splotches on the page. And what we realized was in one of Tolkien's letters in 1962 that he wrote one of his aunts, he mentioned that he wept while he wrote the chapter, The Field of Cormallen.
He even
cited in the letter the exact like lines.
Okay. Oh, my gosh.
And so wouldn't you know it? Those splotches are like right where those lines are.
Wow.
And so we thought that, well, that's as much of a dead ringer as you're going to get from evidence. So we've sort of presented it as, you know, here's this object, which is kind of boring. It's a page of manuscript from a novel, but it has like the significance of these tear stains on it, so it sort of turns it into almost an artifact.
That's amazing.
So there's some things like that, but we don't have a lot of the glitzy drawings that you get at the Bodleian.
Sure. I would imagine dealing with the manuscripts, with these firsthand drafts that you have, there's a insight into the mind that we don't get in the published work, right? You get to see the revisions and the marginalia and the doodles, right? Do you have favorite moments of that? Like, do you have your favorite Tolkien doodles, your favorite word that he crossed out and replaced it with a different one, right? Like, what's the ephemera here?
Gosh, there are a number of them that are engaging that way that... I mean, the fact that there are 11,000 pages of material, like 9,000 for The Lord of the Rings, tells you a lot about Tolkien as a writer. He was a reviser. And so a lot of people who who read it may not realize just how much effort he put into writing the book,
right.
And in some cases how bad those early drafts were, you know. And then he kept working at it and working at
right.
it, and it turned out much better. But there are certainly pivotal moments, and we have to thank his son Christopher for alerting us to a lot of those, because Christopher, after his father's death, he essentially retired from academia and devoted the rest of his life to publishing his father's unpublished works. And so we know so much more about his father's writings because of Christopher.
Sure.
But he did a history of Middle Earth, and in particular within that, a history of the writing of the Lord of the Rings. And so a lot of what we know is really first pointed out by him, even here at Marquette's, in Marquette's collection, because he worked with us when he was writing those books. Not me personally, this was before my time, but so we know a lot. So he's really helped to zero in on a lot of those pivotal moments. There are some really nice pages of doodling where Tolkien is coming up with different words, or is thinking about the story. Maybe there are different plot notes where he's visualizing what might happen in the tale. Those are some really nice moments. But I guess one, Joe, to give you a more specific one, there is one wonderful piece where in the chapter Three is Company, which is in book one of the Lord of the Rings, where the hobbits are going across the Shire. There's this pivotal moment where they're going across the Shire, and they run into a horseman, and in the original draft, it's Gandalf on the horse, which is fine. But then Tolkien, almost immediately after writing that scene, he goes back in pencil and he starts to edit it faintly. We're changing it from Gandalf into the Black Riders that are hunting the hobbits, and so that's an incredibly important moment in the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's interesting because he didn't really know what they were when he brought them into the tale. They just kind of, like, I guess they felt true at that moment in the story that
absolutely.
It's not Gandalf, but it's this Black Rider. That's
amazing.
And so that's a really powerful one. And it's really cool to think, you know, like those little pencil scratches that are on the paper are kind of the birth of the Nazgul there.
Amazing. Yeah, absolutely outstanding.
So it's like you're watching his instinct kind of take over. His instinct is his sense of story, his sense of, like, this shouldn't be a positive meeting. This should be a foreboding meeting. Mm-hmm. Almost a little bit like you're kind of conjuring him a little bit. Like we imagine the choice to say this isn't right. Let's follow it up. Get almost a biographical sense of him. Like, this is the guy knows his instincts. The guy knows good monster stories, and the monsters are mysterious. So we're going to introduce a mysterious monster here. That's so good.
Yeah. It's really neat to be kind of with him on that journey with the manuscript, so you can follow him at moments like that. Not all moments are as dramatic as that, but it is neat to follow along.
Bill, about 15 years ago, Ian and I, along with some other friends, attended a Lord of the Rings themed bar trivia night where there was a magnet for everybody in Wisconsin who knew everything about Lord of the Rings to attend.
Sure.
And I will say, I was quite proud that Ian crushed all of them. My question
is,
do you ever... put on a fake mustache and go to some of these things and just destroy the competition?
Well, actually,
no, I avoid them like the plague. I don't.
You just sit in the corner with a pipe.
Well, my wife one time for Christmas got me like the Lord of the Rings Trivial Pursuit, and we played it once because I won it in one round. Got all the little wedges and won the entire game. So,
amazing.
So she, you know, we don't really play it anymore. We never have since. You do encounter some Tolkien fans who kind of like trumpet how much they know.
Yeah.
Right.
And I would like
Ian.
To meet Stephen Colbert, but, you know, he always comes across like, I know, you know, I don't know if that's his true persona or whether it's
It's like, a little off-putting.
An act.
I think he just genuinely loves it. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's like I've never felt like I have to, and I do occasionally come on people like, well, like ask me trivia questions. It's almost like a, you know, what do you really know? Almost
like
someone, if someone defines themselves too much by something like their knowledge of Tolkien, or I don't know, fill in the blank with something else.
Sure.
Sometimes people can want to like show how much they know, or somehow, you know, show that they know more. Yeah. And I know there are people that know more than I do. I mean, there are people I go to with questions and things that I know nothing about, or things, people I really respect that I know an incredible amount. But what most interests me is not necessarily learning like the minutiae, but more like people who have ideas or have thought about things in a way I never have about Tolkien. I think that's what I like most about interacting with Tolkien fans and that sort of thing.
So the collection, as we know it, it's been kind of in and out of the public eye. Is this something that people can come and experience? How can people experience this? And then tell me a little bit about, I think there's some process going on right now for a digital version of this. Tell me how, you know, true fans can experience this collection.
Yeah, that's a question I face a lot, and I kind of wrestle with a little bit, because these are great treasures. And while there has been kind of an ebb and flow over the years, as certain events happen, like the Peter Jackson films, and then, you know, maybe the Rings of Power, or certainly the advent of different things on the internet, which have, you know, brought like podcasts, like your podcast, that bring people together. There has been an ebb and flow, but there has been a pretty steady interest in Tolkien going back decades. Mm. I mean, before the Peter Jackson films, there was a fan base that was robust that stayed in. And when Marquette owns something as precious as the market of the Tolkien manuscripts, you know, we can't keep them locked away like Smaug, you know, sitting on them. We have to have some way for people to interact with them. And it's a challenging thing to, I guess, manage, because there are limitations with copyright. We don't own the copyright to the manuscripts. That's retained by the Tolkien estate. So it's limited the sort of things we can do. So we do keep a display, and this was something I'm sure Ian saw when he was here back in, you know, years ago at Marquette, that we keep a display up year round in the reading room of some reproductions for traffic that just passes through, people who are kind of pilgrims, for lack of a better term, who want to make a pilgrimage here, and they stop and take a look. If people come wanting to see the original manuscripts, I have to disappoint them. In fact, I had to disappoint a fan this week who's wanting to come from, I think, to see originals coming from the East Coast. Saying I just don't do private showings, because if I did, that's all I would do, because people would come. And so the reproductions have to kind of suffice it, so have to satisfy people, or maybe do an exhibition like we did at the Hagerty. We're kind of taking a break from exhibitions because we got some other stuff we have to deal with that's on our plate. But one thing I started doing this year. I'd actually begun it. I've been doing these pre-COVID, like 80 times a year. I do a public showing for about 25 people, always well attended. And so now I decided, well, I don't have the time to do that many per year, because it takes up a lot of bandwidth to try to get the showing and bringing the stuff out and do all that. And so I decided I'd just do two a year, one in March around Tolkien Reading Day, which is March 25th, the Fall of Sauron Day.
Then
September 22nd, Bilbo and Frodo's birthday, Hobbit Day, as it's called. So I thought, well, I'll do a showing, and I'll make it a little bigger, maybe like 50 or 60 people. So I announced those dates in January. And within 72 hours, like all 50 slots were filled. I've had a wait list that's kept growing and growing. Jeez. And it's like, you know, it's so difficult to not be able to satisfy everybody. Now, the digitization question, what happened? Yeah, we have been digitizing them. And that's part of a broader effort to better understand the collection. And this is actually something that Marquette has, I think, in pursuing this project, which I began several years ago now, I see it as completing something Marquette's been wanting to do since 1990, I mean, way back 30 years ago. And that's to kind of reprocess the collection to better organize it and bring it together in a way that researchers can navigate it more easily and understand what they're looking at. And it's taken a long time and a lot of work, but we have like I said, at this point, a beta version of a database that we keep in the reading room that allows people to come in and study the manuscript collection and navigate through working with digital images. Because there's scholarship in Tolkien and Lord of the Rings that goes back a long time, there have been like shelf marks and citations for pointing to manuscripts in the collection. And so when I said about wanting to reprocess the collection, I didn't want to like move pages around and refolder things and shift stuff because it was sort of locked in its shelf mark for years. So the idea then was to scan everything and then to reorganize it with the digital surrogates. Because then you can rearrange things because the collection, the way it came in over the years, the stuff we got from Tolkien, Professor Tolkien in the 1950s, and then his son Christopher sent a large number of additional manuscripts in later years. They, in some cases, you know, there are bits all over from different drafts. And so bringing them together and trying to sort out how they fit together and present it digitally was the whole point of the project. And so it's culminated in this database that we call Anduin. We named it after the great river of Wilderland, the great river of Middle Earth, because one of the things we noted as we were mapping out, and I turned to Tolkien scholars to help me with this, while we were mapping out the collection and how the pieces fit together, it looked like this river of creativity that just flowed out of him from 1937 until, you know, he finishes a draft around 48 or 49. And so that's why we decided to call it Anduin. It's amazing. So that tool is available. Because of the copyright, we can't put the images up online for everybody to enjoy. Sure. I would love to be able to do that, but it's just not happening. people have to come to the reading room to see the images.
Really cool.
But it has, I think, really sped up research because prior to this point, people had to work with photocopies or microfilm, and it was very laborious and tough. And so this does speed things up for the researchers.
Could you talk on this note? Could you talk a little bit about the oral history collection? I was not aware of this. Is that still kind of being built? What's
It's still going. It's kind of one of these things that I decided to pursue, making the decision with my heart and not with my head, because I think if I made it with my head, true. I would never have done it.
Okay.
Because, but it is still operational, and Ian, you definitely need to do an interview. We'll have to link up after.
All right.
But what I decide. So I mentioned that we document the fandom, and fandom's really hard to document with the rise of the internet. It's just explosion. It's proliferating. It's impossible, really. And so what I decided to do was kind of collect brief oral histories from fans. And this idea came out of the fact that we are a pilgrimage site. And so on a Friday afternoon, there may just suddenly be a couple people from Germany that are in the reading room looking at the display. And if I'm available, I would come out and say hi and chat with them. And then people would share a story or something. And I thought to myself, well, these are the kind of moments that we should be capturing. And so what that evolved into was a goal to collect 6,000 interviews from Tolkien fans. Each of them, each person's limited to only up to 3 minutes. So they have to be selective in what they want to say.
But I'm sure like that's difficult for some of them.
Oh, yeah. It's very difficult. I've never heard people speak so fast in my life. But they have only up to 3 minutes to share. And then what I do is I take just the audio and make that available online and then create a transcript of the people could read if they preferred and then have that keyword searchable So if you want to see, like, you know, who's mentioning Galadriel, if they have 3 minutes, you can type her name in, and then it'll have all
that
the
so
interviews
cool.
that say really Galadriel. Cool. But then it also has a research component, in that what I do is I take the transcript of text and the metadata, like age, gender, where the person's from, and I put it in a data set, and then people can download that data set, and so they could study across the interviews. So that's the concept. And I set 6,000 as the goal because that was the number of riders of Rohan that Theoden musters and elites to Minas Tirith. So I thought that's great.
Obviously.
To fans. There's like one fan for every rider of Rohan.
Ian, just raise your hand every time you're really excited by these references.
Maybe a bow.
A horn, Joe, a horn.
But I'm still building it. In fact, it's very interesting because when I first started doing it, there was this huge upsurge, and then it kind of goes in ebbs and flows. And the reason I made this decision with my heart and not with my head is that I'm only now at like 1,250 interviews out of 6,000. And that's a lot. And I've got them from 40 different countries. And I've gone to France and Germany in person to collect interviews when I've had an opportunity. So there's an international component to it. But I've been kind of surprised it hasn't like filled up quicker. I think in some cases people, they like the idea, but they're sort of hesitant to do it, or they want to think it through. You know, like I'm gonna really think through what I want to say, and then they never end up doing it.
What would you like people to share?
No. Well, what I do is I ask them just to, when they talk, to respond to 3 questions, and that's, you know, when did you first encounter Tolkien? Which researchers would like to know, like, how did people come to him?
Yeah.
Was it through the movies? Was it because their parent read it to them? A friend showed them it? What could, you know, what is it? And then the other one is, you know, why are you a fan, or why do you like him?
Sure.
Like his works. And then what has Tolkien meant to you? And so that's very open-ended, because for some people it may be, well, he's not really meant anything. I just like the books. You know, they're entertaining. Yeah. For other people, it's actually almost becomes a quasi-religion, where he's such an incredible influence on their life, changed their life, and, you know, the ideas and themes and the teachings of the Lord of the Rings and Gandalf and the Hobbits almost become like their gospel that they live by. And so he could mean a lot to people, as well as, you know, being very, you know, casual interest for fans. But
that's,
I don't discriminate at, you know, anybody, no matter how much or how little, if they say, yeah, I'm a fan, then they should do it.
Have you done it? Were you the first one? Were you,
no,
the first
interview?
No, I'm
going to be the last.
You're going to be the 6,000? Okay, 6,000. Very cool.
I've saved 6,000 for myself. I don't know that I'll live to see it. But,
after this goes live, don't
worry. Once you get the you don't know it bomb.
That's where you do your heel turn. It actually doesn't mean anything to me. I hate this guy. It's the worst. You got your chips.
Gotcha.
That's really cool.
I will make a shameless... a shameless plea
to your loyal
listeners, that if any of you, you know, like Tolkien or would be interested in sharing your thoughts, please do so. You can just Google online, you know, Tolkien fandom oral history or Marquette, and you'll see a link. You could just go to the calendar and pick a time slot when I'm available. It only takes a few minutes. Each time slot's like 15 minutes. Just a few minutes. We meet up on Zoom. And then do the capture the interview. It's a really good process.
What a cool way to be a part of history.
Really cool.
That's really amazing. I have one last question. Ian and Joe might too.
Uh huh. Oh.
Okay. Gotta pick a movie. Which is your favorite
movie?
Yes.
Movie.
Notice he's not asking about the Lord of the Rings. You can say any movie. You can say, like,
he's like, I'm really gonna Die Hard with a Vengeance.
You know, here's
gonna do questions.
I'll give you kind of like 2 answers in a way. One is, I'm of an age, and I've noticed this.
You can pick a book too if you want.
Well, no, I'm of an age, and I've noticed this in the fandom oral histories I've gathered, that there's some of us for whom we first encountered Tolkien through the Rankin-Bass Hobbit yeah. animated.
Oh, he's going to go hipster. He's going to go OG hipster here, you guys. Watch
it's
this.
It's possible.
And so I have a certain fondness that goes there back to childhood for that production.
Yeah, of course.
But I would say in terms of the films, really the ones I really appreciate, and like I think The Fellowship of the Ring, that first film, was the best. I honestly thought that each film after was a little worse than the one before.
We'll bleep it out. Don't worry. We'll bleep it out.
We'll cut it out. It's fine. Yeah.
But I liked Fellowship of the Ring. I really enjoyed that first film.
When that music kicks in at the beginning of Fellowship, like when Gandalf is riding on the cart and you just get that Hobbit, just nothing makes me happier in the world. Like nothing in the world.
I'm going to watch it tonight and stay up till 3 a.m.
Yeah, I can remember going opening night to a theater in Racine, Wisconsin, and going to see Fellowship of the Ring. And I had kind of low expectations. I didn't really know what to expect. And sure, I went in and I came out and I thought, wow, that was really good. You know, I was kind of surprised how much I liked it because I had such a bibliophile with, you know, I love the book so much.
Every episode we end with like a quote. So Joe and Ian usually bring book recommendations, and I pick a winner just to piss one of them off.
Yep.
And
it always does.
And so the winner gets to read a quote from their book. Not to put you on the spot, do you have a favorite quote from the body of work?
I'll do one from Lord of the Rings because I like the Silmarillion almost more than the Lord of the Rings, but I'll stay away from Silmarillion quotes. But a lot of times the quotes I like, but also just even passages, just they're so beautifully written, just the way he can craft a sentence. But I do like I think of all the characters in Lord of the Rings, Faramir is my favorite character of all the characters, for a variety of reasons. And I didn't really like what the movies did with him. I think they kind of, it was
ruined
bad.
Him. Yeah, I've heard this before.
Yeah. But I do like him. And that chapter, The Window on the West, in book four is such a beautiful chapter. He really lays out and as a historian, I really appreciate how he kind of lays out the history and he's so full of lore and he shares that and he does it so well. There's a moment where he's talking about kind of his dreams for Gondor and that, and he's lamenting the fact that Gondor has sort of become this, sort of lessened itself and become more of a warrior culture like Rohan from the more higher culture it was once upon a time. And how martial prowess is most highly valued in Gondor the way it wasn't many, you know, generations before. And he says, you know, I do not love the bright sword for its sharpness, nor the arrow for its swiftness, nor the warrior for his glory. I love only that which they descend, the city of the men of Numenor. And I would have her love for her memory, her ancient tree, her beauty, and her present wisdom, not feared, save as men may fear the dignity of a man old and wise.
Thank you, Bill. This was fun.
Yeah, Bill, absolutely awesome.
It's really, really good.